Storytelling is a 65,000-year-old plus way of expression for Indigenous communities, with the oral tradition of passing on stories from one generation to the next, an integral part of First Nations cultures around the world. But in a modern context, these traditions are being transformed to meet the challenges of evolving technologies and expanding audiences. From radio to film and now the internet, the mediums being mastered by Indigenous storytellers are as diverse as the tales they tell. Associate Professor Pauline Clegg is a filmmaker, the artistic director of Winder Film Festival, and a mentor to emerging Indigenous filmmakers. She's thought deeply about the distinctiveness of Indigenous storytelling, and she joins me now to share her reflections. Pauline, welcome back to Speaking Out.
G'day everyone, thank you.
What draws you to visual storytelling?
I suppose for me, I was always going to be a storyteller. As a teenager, I was interested in radio and I worked for Koori Radio as a teenager when I first came to Sydney. The passion, I suppose, came out of realising that film can change someone. As an eight-year-old, I think I've told this story to a few people out there, but as an eight-year-old, I watched To Kill a Mockingbird and I thought I wanted to be Atticus. And so I went to law school, got into law, and then in my second year watched To Kill a Mockingbird again and realised that it was the film and left law. And I think it's that sort of thing that made me always think about that. Plus also the fact that I was the little girl in my community that always made the tea. So I was always around the aunties hearing the stories and my mum and dad and just sort of kind of being really involved in understanding, especially as a teenager, what their work and what they were doing, how it impacted the rest of Australia, especially for Indigenous people.
You've worked in radio, you've worked in television, you've worked in film, and now you are using different technologies around visual storytelling and encouraging other emerging filmmakers to do that. Can you tell us a little bit about the way in which you're finding new technologies can help tell the stories in a visual way?
I think the new technology allows accessibility to our communities, and that's the greatest thing, is that we see great filmmakers like Curtis Taylor and Tyson Moir and in WA still in their communities. When I first started in the film industry, we all had to move to Sydney, and now the freedom to be able to stay in your community and work in your community and evolve with the new technologies, because it's out there for all of us to, it's not unachievable to be a filmmaker in this country nowadays.
And you actually do quite a lot of work, I know, in going out to communities and training particularly young people to then be able to do filmmaking. Why has that been such a central part? Obviously, the technology's there, but this is a real commitment on your part to facilitate storytelling.
It's all about voice. Our voice in this country is not recognised properly. We talk about truth, voice and treaty for NAIDOC this year, or, you know, even the reconciliation theme for this year is all about grounding yourself in truth. Well, that's about giving people the right voice and their voice, not someone else's, for them to be able to have that energy. And I think there's been such a suppression on the freedom of thought for our children, that identity has become really crushing for a lot of our communities. And there's been, you know, suicide levels. You know, I hate the fact that our young people are seen as a statistic nowadays rather than being able to play and find out who they are and find out what their connection to their country is by not having the voice in their communities. And I think that's the main reason why it drives me to constantly go back to community and do the work.
When you do work with young people in that context, what's been the sort of transformation you see as they start to understand the potential of visual storytelling?
I always go back to this. The two kids that keep me inspired all the time. One, he's not so much a kid nowadays, but Lukey Mabb, who's down in Tasmania, we did a workshop with him about 20 years ago. And they were kids that were either on the street, had troubles, were struggling with life. And that it's funny that everyone thinks that they need more support. And often they're the leaders of our communities because they are noisy and they make a lot of noise because of the fact that they don't get given the voice that they are needed to be given in the community space to be able to grow as leaders. And so working with him, we ended up supporting him through going back up to Cherbourg, and because he had connections to Cherbourg as well, and filming up there and creating an opportunity for him to find a voice about his family, about the connection of Nan Mab to Cherbourg as well as to Tasmania. His whole voice changed to understand the truth of why he needed to be stronger. And watching him grow for the next 10 years was amazing. He became Tasmanian Youth of the Year. He was an accountant for TAC. Like, he's just a really beautiful young man. And when you give... filmmaking often is about allowing young people to tell stories of their elders, and so it connects them back. That's what we often do with those workshops. So it connects them back to their core of their community and finding the message that lives within them, and that's a power, you know.
You're a practical person and you do a lot of hands-on filmmaking and a lot of this practical work in the community. But you've also thought quite deeply about the philosophy of Indigenous filmmaking. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your thoughts, because I think one of the areas where your work's been really transformative is getting people to understand that there is actually a different story structure to the way Indigenous people put together visual storytelling. And it challenges a lot of the mainstream dominant culture orthodoxy around the structure of screenwriting and script. And I was wondering if you could share your reflections on Indigenous story structure.
I mean, I think one of the reasons why I did it was because I think I've always been an analyst of some sort, and trying to figure out if there is a truth to diversity and the acceptance of diversity, then you've got to accept that our view is different to someone else's. And what is that view? If we were going to structurally look at a film, and I'm lucky that I get to watch a lot of films that are made by Indigenous people each year, that there is obviously a beat or there's something different. And it's partly because our storytelling of oral history is different. We don't do the three-act structure well. Even in music, our beats are different. And so that understanding of trying to figure out what it is. And so that's when I came up with the five-act structure and just sort of kind of trying to watch films and go, why is it that people aren't reading our films the way we're reading them? Because a lot of people go, we don't understand why that person moves or why the protagonist isn't as much of a protagonist. And there were shots in there that for me, I was going, I know why that person's moved from A to B. So why isn't it obvious? And that's when I realised that our lens is different and we know that. But what does that lens then look like? If we were going to describe it to someone, what would it look like? And so I started writing the five-act structure back when I was at the film school, because I was working with people like Stephen Cleary, and who were all about deciphering down and analysing scripts. And I was like, well, why is it that they can't read our scripts? And why do we have to transform to be into the three-act structure? Is there a way for us to get them to see that there's a different structure in play?
This work's really been about articulating a different way that Indigenous people express story. Mm. There's been an element of your work where you've sort of analysed the stereotyping of Aboriginal people in non-Indigenous work. And I was wondering if you could share with us the four stereotypes you identified when you as a child were growing up and watching images of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people on screen, but they were primarily almost always written by non-Indigenous people.
Yeah, and I think we often as a community think that they're archetypes, but they're actually stereotypes. They're not deep. They're quite shallow in the way that we see the world. I mean, most people know these stereotypes, the nomadic male, the contemporary Aboriginal man who lives on the fringes and has to be saved by usually a white person. The nomadic Aboriginal male was often the one that would appear mystically in the desert or in the rainforest and save some white children or some white person from their demise within an untamed world of Australia.
Noble savage.
The noble savage, yeah. And then the contemporary female, sadly, I always go back to Aunty Justine Saunders. She used to say she was so glad when Aboriginal people came along to start writing for her because she'd just been raped, pillaged and plundered up until that point. And I think those sort of kind of key stereotypes sometimes haven't changed. We go back to them very quickly in this country. And I think that's part of the problem, is that we force them as an identity shape onto our community, whether that's black or white. You know, sometimes it's easier to write that stereotype because we've all grown up with it. People are used to it. And so as filmmakers, there is a challenge to think outside that square. And what does it look like if we go deeper into the motivations of those characters?
And I'll get to that in a minute, but just in case people were counting, because we mentioned three, but of course you've got the shaman as well.
Yes. Yeah. So the shaman's always been a part of that mystical being that often is really badly understood, is not seen as a healer, is seen as someone that sort of kind of has a connection to the spirit world, but is not connected to this world. And it's that lack of understanding of, you know, that we live in both past, present and future at all times as Indigenous peoples. We're always thinking about all of those three timelines, and they often are not written by white people into film.
Your analysis, your philosophy of film has moved from those critiques of stereotypes, which is a very helpful set of circumstances. But I think the work you're doing now on archetypes is actually also very interesting. Tell us a little bit about why you've started to really think deeply about archetype in Indigenous filmmaking.
I think because there's a lot more people in the industry now. And so there is now the time for us to take breath and have some analytical work done on the body that has been created in the last 25 years, both here and internationally. And that's what's amazing about it, is that if you see a Canadian film or a Maori film or an Australian film, you see the same momentums and the same issues coming up about why is it that, say, a hero and a warrior look really different in that shape? And when you place them into the Jung's archetype, which are the 12 archetypes that everyone sort of kind of lives by in terms of how they write films, then you have to start thinking about whether or not they fit for an Indigenous lens.
So maybe just on that example of the hero versus the warrior, what are your reflections in terms of how the archetypes, as they might appear in non-Indigenous film, the hero, compare to the way that you would see the parallel archetype in an Indigenous story of the warrior?
It's mainly in motivation. I mean, the interesting thing about it is that for a hero, their motivation is based in an egotistical sort of space, that they thrive to do something that gives them the impact back. For a warrior, it has a communal motivation, that it's not just about the ego, but it's about a communal thought process about, I do it for my community. It always was, it always will be, kind of motto, which sort of encompasses not just them, but it encompasses their whole community and being. And so the motivation, if it's stuck within that communal framework, then some of that ego traits start to be deciphered as really different. You can't see the world in the same way because he's not acting just for himself, and in actual fact can sacrifice himself for the greater good of his community. And so how do we make that look differently? And that's about teaching white people what our lens is for those archetypes.
You've also written about the way in which the merging of the magic realism type story and horror are being embraced by Indigenous filmmaking. Why is this a space that Indigenous filmmakers are so drawn to?
I think because we've all grown up with the stories in our communities as little kids. I remember my uncles used to dress up, you know, paint their faces up and scare us all at nighttime with the stories of like Hairy Man or, you know.
Yeah.
We have a fascination of it because some of our stories about lore are embraced by these stories of, and I wouldn't call them mystical beings because we know they're real. And that's the difference, is that in a lens of genre, for horror, it can be an unknown, or and for Aboriginal and Indigenous cultures, it may not be seen, but it is very much a part of our reality of the world. And so that's sort of trying to figure out what our genres are, because they're not quite horror, they're not quite thriller, they're not quite magical realism. They're a merge of all of those things. So we've been calling them chillers around the world because they make your spine tingle like they did when you were around the campfire listening to stories as a little kid.
And just finally tonight, you've also, as I mentioned, you're the artistic director of the Winder Film Festival, which you started, and it is becoming a major Indigenous film festival, growing every year. But what can we look out for with the festival this year?
There's some amazing documentaries around this year, feature docs, and there's been a real move, I think, in the last couple of years internationally to see some real collaborations. I don't know if it's this year or next year, but Australia and New Zealand are doing the 2020, the Chiller series up in the Arctic of Canada, the Sami people and the Russian mob, Saka mob. We're going to see some really interesting dynamics about collaboration, international collaboration, as well as starting to really understand genres within our Indigenous space. It's a really exciting time because, you know, we've been around for 25 years now and people are now starting to play. And that's where we all hoped we would get to. We're all in it for the long haul, you know. I don't think I could ever stop being a storyteller. And so that's what I find really exciting, is that we're hoping to bring a couple of big international filmmakers across with their new works. So stay tuned. It's on the 21st to the 24th of November in Sydney.
Well, hopefully you can come back and tell us about it a little bit more once all is revealed. Thank you so much for being with us this evening and sharing with us what I think has become a really important part of the deeper understanding about the uniqueness of Indigenous storytelling on film.
Thanks, Larissa.
Associate Professor Pauline Clegg is a filmmaker, Artistic Director of the Winder Film Festival and Head of the Cultural Resilience Unit at the Jumbana Institute.